would this look like? How do they need to adapt? And what would transformational change kind of look like in the context of global governance? And there are these various terms that you use in your paper, anticipatory governance and polycentric governance and no regrets action. Can you talk about some of these?
Yeah, so we outline a whole number of approaches for how existing institutions, especially the UNFCCC, can be adapted or adjusted to take account of the risks of climate tipping points or Earth system tipping points. But we also have, we start with kind of a discussion of what should be the general principles for governance of such a kind of problem. So these are kind of two different avenues to take. So first of all, what types of logics or ways of decision-making or thinking should guide governance for tipping points, which are nonlinear large-scale processes that we haven't really tried to address before? And then what does this mean in the context of these existing institutions to move forward? We also look into the fact that given that these tipping processes are at large scales, but affect, of course, multiple scales of human organization and social life. So tipping systems are usually at a scale where they cover multiple countries or even a whole continent. And so you could have a global scale for these. You could have the regional tipping point scale governance. There's a national scale that matters for decision making relating to those tipping points because certain drivers of these tipping points exist at the national scale. And then there are also, of course, impacts at local and individual scales. So there's governance approaches will need to cross multiple scales and try to ensure that there's cross-scale coherence and interactions for our efforts to address tipping processes. So that's one of the big frameworks we suggest that, of course, we need to look at this through a multi-scale lens, and that has to do with what we call polycentric governance. We do emphasize that given the very challenging temporal dynamics of tipping processes, governance should be much more anticipatory, which means future-oriented or forward-looking, than most of our current governance approaches. So our dominant frameworks in global governance tend to take maybe a number of years or maybe a decade into the future perspective at a maximum. So we see that, for example, within the Paris Agreement, we have this tool that's called the NDC, the Nationally Determined Contributions, where countries are supposed to submit promises and pledges for what they will do over the next 5 or 10 years. But when we have tipping processes, we know that these unfold over much longer time horizons and that we want to understand how to prevent them and how to deal with their impacts. We also have to be able to take into account these much longer time horizons. But they are not only long time horizons, they're also short ones. So we need to really understand how decisions that we make within the next 5, 10, maybe 15 years collectively can or cannot prevent some of these tipping points that can then lead to changes, if we don't prevent them, could lead to changes over hundreds or thousands of years. And so being able to grasp these temporal dynamics that connect short-term decision-making to really long-term impacts and deal with that requires much more anticipatory tools, both in terms of how we develop knowledge, the kinds of decision-making frameworks that can assess distant future threats, medium-term threats, and near-term threats that come with tipping points and put them all into a decision-making framework, the kinds of, let's say, normative or ethical frameworks that we use to understand the, let's say, the responsibility of actors living today for preventing these tipping processes, because for some of these, only this generation of existing decision makers or people alive can actually prevent these tipping processes. People who are born today or who will become decision makers in the 2030s or 40s will no longer even have the chance to prevent these from happening once we've triggered them. So there's a significant weight on decision makers today to reconsider what it means that the prevention of some of these tipping points is in their hands and their hands only.
And what sorts of institutions would be required, Manyana Milka-Wright, or institutional, governmental, intergovernmental, institutional reforms to govern with tipping points in mind? Like, for example, a governance mandate for the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, for the AMOC. Like, if one were to think, Jesus, this would be dreadful if the AMOC shut down. It's been reportedly slowing down. But if it stopped, it would be a catastrophe globally. So how does one govern? What kinds of governmental institutions would be required in order to govern for the AMOC?
So that's one particularly tricky one. So for one, because it's an ocean circulation for which the key drivers, as we understand them, are again global temperature change. So we would have to go back to trying to address global temperature change, meaning climate change. So we do need there a framework that involves multiple countries, if not all countries in the world, to work together to address the key driver of this process. And that it, then you come back to global governance, right? You need to have countries get together to understand what is driving changes in that ocean circulation. And in addition to that key global driver, we might have other scale drivers that contribute. And to the extent that they can, then figure out, okay, so what either global maximum temperature or what kinds of concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere are the maximum that we should have to make sure we are not transgressing that tipping point. So we want to, again, go to limiting global temperature. So we have the tools for that one exist, or at least we're trying to address that one, in the existing framework of climate governance, managing global temperature increase through mitigation. So we have to find ways to accelerate efforts of mitigating global greenhouse gas emissions, accelerating our mitigation efforts, phasing out fossil fuels. So we need a kind of governance that is able to manage the important influence of economic interests, right, that shape why the politics as they are today, why countries are interested in continuing the existing patterns of economic production and energy production that we have. We're tied to fossil fuels because that is a cheap and efficient way of producing energy. There's strong interest in maintaining a reliable energy infrastructure that makes a lot of money in a particular set of countries and companies. And these strong interests in maintaining things the way they are have political power. And that political power is, of course, also expressed in national interests. So countries are slow in responding to this kind of information and these risks because they believe that their interests are often in maintaining what exists and in maintaining opportunities for future development in the developing world, for example, with the use of these available, cheap, and well-understood energy technologies and resources. So and if we want to address that, so figuring out how to untie countries' actions from their perceived economic interests, that would help.
Talk about positive tipping points, self-propelling positive tipping points. This is the encouraging part of your group's paper, and particularly the role of small groups within societies and across societies who engage in positive action.
Yeah, so the fourth section of our report is about opportunities for accelerating positive change, especially in the domain of decarbonizing our economies and societies, through what we call positive tipping points. So in the same way that I explained to you what Earth system tipping points are, we believe that tipping dynamics can also exist in societies, because so societies are also systems where things are connected in different kinds of ways and under the right kinds of conditions. A small change can create what you might call maybe a chain reaction or an accelerating set of self-propelling feedback dynamics that lead the existing system to move towards a different state. And we're looking here particularly at contagion effects within networks of different actors, where particular kinds of behavioral norms, for example, can spread sometimes very rapidly within a community or within a society. Whether that comes to what kinds of technologies we adopt or what kinds of food we eat, what kinds of travel and transportation patterns we adopt. And so this potential for nonlinear changes in social systems, whether that's within a community or within the whole world, that gives us a kind of hope to see that we might be able to accelerate the types of solutions that we are already seeing emerging in the world right now. For example, the often cited example of the spread of electric vehicles, although that also has significant negative sustainability implications in other parts of the world, but we see that in the developed world right now. Then changes to transportation systems, changes in diets. So lots of different ways in which positive tipping could help us make progress on decarbonization.
And these are sometimes called virtuous cascades.
Mm-hmm. Because again, like in the Earth system, there are also within societies systems that are connected to each other. And once you trigger one tipping process, then that has knock-on effects or cascading effects potentially in other systems. So for example, some economic sectors are linked that way, that if you have a tipping point in one, that has beneficial impacts on creating change and accelerating change possibly in another.
How can governments promote positive tipping points?
So that's one of the key questions. So the positive tipping points are at this point still something that is rather new in our research. So lots more work is needed to understand that better. But we do believe at this point that we understand that positive tipping points is not something that happens on its own. It requires significant efforts, often from actors in multiple domains, governments, economic actors, but also civil society actors, to move a system towards the point where it can tip. So and these significant efforts need then to be coordinated between these actors. But often it turns out that governments do play a key role. So they can create the enabling conditions through strategic, coordinated policies that help either sectors or certain subsystems of a society move towards a tipping point. So we've seen that, for example, with the spread of renewable power. Once solar power or wind power production reaches a certain price point where it becomes competitive with other energy sources, then it suddenly takes off, right? It's a self-propelling set of changes that then becomes more rapid at a certain point in time. But to create that price parity, a long chain of policy decisions, technological developments, and so forth were necessary to move the system towards that place where this could happen rapidly. And government policies that enabled this type of technology to become large scale and affordable and to spread that technology, its adoption in society, were necessary, whether that's feed-in tariffs and the German energy policy over the last 20 or 30 years, or other technology supporting policies in other countries. Those were a component of creating the enabling conditions. So for each system or positive tipping system that you're trying to move towards the tipping point, you need to again be able to understand, first of all, what the system looks like, what the system components are and what state they are, and what types of changes or levers you might have to move that system into a state where it is more likely to start self-accelerating.
You're calling for a global summit on tipping points.
So one of the key challenges that we face at this point is that understanding and awareness of this phenomenon is still very limited. At the same time, action to adjust our governance institutions and to try to minimize the risks of passing tipping points is now urgent. So we've seen over time with our scientific assessments that the risk of transgressing tipping points has come closer and closer. So we now, when we started to talk about tipping points 15, 20 years ago, the IPCC assessed the risks of passing Earth's tipping points at much higher temperatures. And over time, the temperature in which we believe these can happen has come down. So that today we believe at the current temperature, 5 tipping points are already at risk of being tipped. And so given this urgency and the lack of awareness and the lack of specific measures to tackle these, makes us think that an international summit could help create that awareness, could bring together actors from governments around the world, but also, of course, industry and civil society to, first of all, advance significantly our collective assessment of this risk, our understanding, and our attempt to create a governance response for these, both maybe at the global scale for the whole set of global tipping points that exist, but also maybe at specific regional scales that could tackle particular types or specific individual tipping elements. So to kickstart that kind of collective effort, global summits can have that kind of effect to bring us together, to make us think about a particular challenge for a condensed amount of time and to foster, hopefully, the shared will to address this type of risk moving forward, while also bringing in, of course, the need to think much harder about the potential to leverage the positive tipping points and the kinds of efforts that are needed to do that. And for creating the collective will and to kind of mobilize that agenda on governing global tipping points, both good and bad, we think a global summit would be very useful to focus our minds, at least for a couple of days, on this issue.
And again, I mean, I think that the greatest challenge here, coming to the end of our conversation, is thinking about the world and our situations, our environments around us as systems, which is very difficult for people, because systems analysis requires, once you identify the system, and it's incredibly complex, you start teasing it apart and thinking, who do I need to be speaking with? Who do I need to be collaborating with? People I've never worked with or collaborated with before.
Absolutely. I think systems thinking and an understanding of systems could be a key facilitator of more collaborative and more effective actions to address these complicated global challenges. And so one big step forward might be a larger effort to do systems education, right? In our educational systems, to focus much more on systems thinking and to looking through a system lens at our realities. As you said, if it's our cities or even our families, our schools, and our relationship to the environment. We are tightly coupled. We live in tightly coupled social, ecological, or social environmental systems. And so seeing ourselves in that way might help us both understand the problems better and also devise better solutions.
Last question, Manjana Milka-Wright. What's the next step for your Global Tipping Points report? This is the first report of its sort. What's the next step?
So there are a number of next steps. So of course, right now we focus on engaging different audiences with the findings of our report. So having it published is great, but that is certainly not where it ends. The work isn't done. Now it's about translating this, the findings of our report, into hopefully actionable insights for different audiences, whether that's governments or industry actors or civil society actors. And then comes the question of when there will be a second report. So we're hoping that this will be a repetitive exercise. Potentially in a couple of years from now, there might be another report to follow up on this. And then there are plans to strengthen and expand on the work on positive tipping points in particular. I mentioned that this is a still very young field of research, and a lot more work is needed to understand whether and under what conditions social systems might be able to tip, and how that could be governed or steered or navigated, and what that implies. So there will be, an expanded effort of research on positive tipping points in particular.
Manjana Milka-Wright, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Thanks for having me today, David.
Manjana Milka-Wright is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Oslo in Norway and lead author of Chapter 3 of the first Global Tipping Points report. Listen to our complete conversation and link to the report at greenplanetmonitor.net. Natural ecosystems are home to a wide range of plants and animals. Cities are ecosystems too. The healthiest ones coexist with nature. On the edge of one of Canada's largest cities, the benefits provided by natural ecosystems and the importance of protecting them are on display. Here's a story from Hamilton, Ontario, a place called Coots Paradise. I'm standing on the edge of a four-lane highway on the edge of the city of Hamilton on the western tip of Lake Ontario, the heart of urban Canada. Cars and trucks barrel east to Toronto and Montreal and south to Niagara Falls, Detroit and beyond. A few hundred yards away, gazing in the opposite direction, something much more tranquil, an open expanse of blue water bounded by green forest. This is Coots Paradise, the largest patch of intact coastal wetland on the western end of Lake Ontario. Coots Paradise is an oasis of silence and nature. In the heart of the city, it's an intact ecosystem where wildlife thrives and humans seek refuge from the urban grind.
Where we are is so beautiful right now. It's amazing.
David Mivesayer paddles Coots in his canoe.
I moved here from Vancouver, which people say is one of the most beautiful cities in the world and so spectacular. But Hamilton, even though it's a very industrial port city, is also so beautiful. I can't believe where we are right now.
And if you were to take away the sound of the Highway 403 and the cars, you'd think you were in the middle of kind of nowhere.
It does look that way, sure. If I took a photograph right now, we could be out in the wilderness. It's totally amazing. Like, we're actually in the middle of a city of over 500,000 people. The steel mills and train tracks and highways.
In the South Shore, in the Coots, we have found at least 80 species of fresh mushrooms. So it's very diverse.
On the forested South Shore of Coots Paradise, Shanping Shu is content searching for fungi. JP, as he's called, is a biologist at McMaster University overlooking Coots Marsh. According to JP, fungal diversity in Coots is on par with some of North America's most intact forests.
Over here, there's a very interesting mushroom.
JP and I bend down to take a close look at the mushroom. Then, a tiny surprise. Well, there's a little frog. There's a little frog.
Yeah, look at this one. Isn't that pretty?
JP is more interested in the mushroom. He's got a permit to explore Coots, including areas closed to the public. And he very much appreciates the importance of this place.
The ecological niche is actually very, very suitable for a lot of growth. There's a lot of water. The topography is quite diverse. So it's a very, very good place for a lot of organisms, but it's also a good place for us humans to enjoy.
They don't call it a paradise for nothing.
They don't call it a paradise for nothing, yes.
Coots surely was a paradise back in the 1780s when British Army officer Thomas Coote hunted and fished here. Since then, urban expansion, soot from Hamilton's famed iron and steel works, and climate change have all taken their toll. 20 years of restoration work has paid off. And here, now here's a trail we used to take along. It's not a trail, it's a sanctuary area, it says.
Yes, that's right. So this is one of the little pockets of lovely habitat in front of us, but it's only lovely habitat if it's not full of people.
Tice Teismeyer is head of natural areas for the Royal Botanical Gardens, the organization that manages Coots. Today, old trails are off limits. Rewilding, it's called. And some people might ask, you know, like, what's the point of having natural area if people can't go into it?
Yes, well, you're into the number one challenge with the planet. If I can't use it all, what's the point? That's all there is.
Tice and I walk through intact Carolinian forest. Walnut, black cherry, tulip, butternuts, and sassafras abound. Now here's a big old tree.
Yeah, this is one of the survivors beside us. It's a red oak, almost a meter across, and stands probably 120 feet tall.
A half dozen creeks feed cold spring water into Coots. Sewer runoff from West Hamilton has been greatly reduced. This water is pretty clean. Tice and I walk between forest and creek. Coots is home to 1,000 plant species and lots of birds. Some hang out here on their long journey between Alaska and southern Chile. But one species of wildlife, a fish, has been most unwelcome, the common carp. introduced at a hatchery on the north shore of Lake Ontario, huge carp soon invaded coots, ripping out marsh roots with their sucker mouths, blasting sediment, and driving out native fish. By 1960, most of Coots Marsh was laid to waste. In 1997, a steel structure was erected across the channel between Coots and Hamilton Harbor. Coots Fishway lets native fish come and go, keeps the carp out.
I mean, we'll definitely be seeing some carp trying to get in, and we'll keep them on the Hamilton Harbor side at least.
Every Friday, Nick Bendo and other Royal Botanical Gardens staff sort through their fishway's catch. Those carp were...
That was a carp.
Pretty active.
And they're very splashy, so you're usually going to get wet.
Having eliminated carp, the next step was restoring Coots Marsh, replanting cattails, water lily, and wild rice. This little marsh wren couldn't be happier, perched and singing in the sunshine. Nearby, great blue herons, snowy white egrets, bitterns, terns, and kingfishers abound. So do beavers, muskrats, and deer. On the edge of a large city, Coots Paradise looks like an intact ecosystem, and urban dwellers like David Miviser are part of that ecosystem. They benefit, too.
Well, it's really important, I think, for our mental health and spiritual balance. Also, I'm sure it provides things like fresh air. These are things for scientists. But for me, I just feel it. If you live in the city, you know, you can be in contact with something that's not completely run by humans.
For more information about Coots Paradise, go to greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, I said it before, I'll say it again. The guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
Kick off summer at the intersection of community, culture, and sport at the Concord Pacific Dragon Boat Festival. Experience the continent's best dragon boat racing, headliner music shows including acts Hey Ocean and Manila Gray, a cultural pavilion and demonstrations, local marketplace and food vendors, and all kinds of family-friendly activities. The festival takes place on June 22nd and June 23rd at False Creek and has free entry.